Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 76, recorded October 31st, 2012. Jonathan Schwartz. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get some of the most interesting, smartest, most provocative people in technology to join us for an hour and talk about their ideas and give you a chance to ask them questions as well. I am thrilled. This was a last-minute booking, and I'm thrilled. I've wanted to talk to Jonathan Schwartz for a long time, formerly CEO and president of Sun Microsystems. But he is a very interesting fellow. He's got a new business called CareZone. We're going to talk about that. Jonathan, welcome to TWiT and to Triangulation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Your tenure at Sun was brief, just a few years.
Well, I was there for 14 years.
They acquired your previous company,
Lighthouse. They acquired my previous company in 1996, right. And then I stuck it out until we sold the company to Oracle.
You were CEO for three years?
3 years, yeah. A little over 3 years.
And did actually the most, and I think it will live forever, most memorable resignation ever on Twitter, which I remember. I mean, I thought that was so cool. You wrote a haiku that said, "Financial crisis stalled too many customers. CEO no more." Wow. That's a resignation.
It was.
But it also struck me as very transparent. Like, you actually were talking not to shareholders, stakeholders, colleagues, fellow employees. You're talking to the world, and you were honest.
Well, I think, you know, when you're talking in general, it's nearly impossible to segregate your audience and say, okay, I'm only talking to these people.
Yeah,
everybody
don't listen.
Else is going to be listening.
Right.
And so, you know, I was talking to all the folks who cared about Sun, and they were our customers, our employees, our partners, our families. Everybody wanted to know what was going on. We wanted to be clear about it.
You were very honest. You now have you can maintain it, but a blog of things you couldn't say when you were CEO.
Yeah, somehow that cease and desist letter from Oracle really kind of put a bit of a kibosh on that. But yeah, there's
so it's
a blog
over
there.
Now.
It's quiet more than it's over.
Really, Oracle said that you may not be CEO any longer, but we would prefer you.
I think
not.
They wanted to make sure that all of the insight and wisdom about what actually went on stayed insight and wisdom and didn't actually see the light of day. But as time has gone on, there's
they're
more
not
and more of it's
that.
Come out. No, of course
talk.
Not. And good news, Oracle's not watching this, right?
They don't watch this, so you can be honest here.
Yeah.
I'm reading the Wikipedia article, and you'll correct me if we've got anything wrong here, but. One of the things they say, which is kind of interesting, is that you nearly died during a horrific train crash.
Yeah.
In 1986.
It's amazing how stuff like that ends up in Wikipedia.
But that's that's an interesting biographical tidbit.
And it was a very important experience in my life. I was on a train with my girlfriend at the time, and we were leaving D.C. on our way back to New York. And for those that remember, at the time, I think the Super Bowl was on. And the reason I know that is, or there was some big game. I think it was the Super Bowl. It's because my parents were walking. They told me later my parents were walking through a shopping mall. And then they recognized that the broadcast of the game had stopped because this accident had occurred. And there were all these people gathering around. And then they realized their son was on the train.
Oh, my God.
And this was back before the internet and back before cell phones. Yeah. And so no one actually was able to communicate with anybody. So they just got in the car and started driving up to see
horrifying.
What was going on. It was horrifying. It was horrifying for everybody involved.
Yeah.
And so I remember that moment. You know, obviously I remember the accident quite clearly, but I remember that moment with my family. I remember that moment with...
The reunion.
It's such a fundamental experience to come that close to losing your life. You begin to... I mean, the world changed. I was a young man. I was still in college. But your perspective on everything just changes.
Like, well, you got okay, serious.
You totally get serious. You get serious and also lighthearted simultaneously. Because all of a sudden, all the stuff you thought mattered doesn't. Move on.
It's a great lesson.
It is a fabulous lesson. I wish there were less traumatic ways of delivering that lesson. But yeah, it was a great lesson.
Yeah, any day could be your last.
Yeah.
And it both simultaneously matters a lot and doesn't matter at all.
Spend time with people you love.
Yeah.
Make sure you remind them of that frequently.
Yeah, that's great.
And do the things that matter. And
that's
absolutely.
Great. So did that lead to a career in technology?
I think that led to, bizarrely, a level of self-confidence surrounding, well, what happens if I fail? I don't care.
Let's go try.
There's worse things
that
could
happen. Right, what's the worst thing that happens? It's like there's no train you're going to run into, so move on. Try this. So I think my appetite for risk went way up. I think my enjoyment in life went way up.
That's great.
And it definitely emboldened me. It just gave me a sense of what is really worth worrying about? What's really worth being afraid of?
Right.
And what's not? And when you're 17, 18 years old, you're in college, you're trying to figure out what happens next, you're very worried about it, you got to worry about a job, you got to worry about this and that. And all of a sudden, I wasn't as worried because I wasn't worried about my family. I wasn't worried about my friends. I wasn't worried about, my life. I could go worry about stuff that mattered.
It gave you perspective on what really...
More than anything else. Yeah. That's exactly what it did.
Yeah. How valuable is that? I remember when you were CEO, it was very pretty. You had a ponytail. Is it? You weren't wearing
a ponytail?
Didn't you?
Oh,
I think you did. You weren't wearing a three-piece suit. You were very much a different guy. You embraced... Now, Sun had somewhat of an open-source heritage. But you embraced it. You embraced it.
Yeah.
In a way that was really inspiring. I mean, it was a very different kind of tech CEO.
And very deliberate. I mean, we had a whole variety of problems, and almost all of them could be traced to our failure to remember our roots. And the roots
making
of the company.
Solaris for
engaging developers, full stop.
Engaging developers.
And I think the same is true today. If you have developers, you will be successful. If you don't have developers, it's going to be a tough road to hoe.
Yeah. And
Sun had basically lost a lot of its developers, and the whole team of us, everybody who was there, wanted to get those developers back. And today, just looking at my startup right now, I can't think of a single proprietary product we use. There's just not one. I mean, maybe there's some proprietary services we use to kind of do, analytics or do payments. But the foundational technology, that we use is open source and free. And I don't think we're anomalous. I think that's just the way that the world works.
How does that help you get developers? I don't understand the nexus.
Most developers are going to go off and make choices about how they go build a system. And Linux is a great example of that. If you're going to go pick an operating system, you are unlikely to go, with all deference and respect to your sponsors, you are unlikely to go off and pick up, Windows and say, I want to go build a Windows app. You're going to go look for the highest volume opportunities that are out there. And you're going to also look at your budget and say, okay, I've got $10,000. What do I want to spend it on?
But that means not open source. That means, in many cases, proprietary. It means iOS, or it means... Android. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean open source. I guess Android is open source. But.
Yeah, well, I think it's hard to run against... Well, first of all, in the time that we were worrying about things, if you were looking at server-side operating systems, for the most part, you were likely looking at an open source operating system.
It was LampStack.
Yeah, it was totally LampStack.
Yeah.
The client side is a little bit different because you've got this consumer phenomena, which is whether it's open source or not doesn't matter. What matters is, are there a lot of consumers using it? And if they are, that's where developers are going to go.
I see.
So I think first there is a barrier for any developer, whether in a big company or a small company, which is how much money do you have? And if products are free, you are more likely to be able, and they're easily accessible, you're going to get them, play with them, experiment with them. And in the event you build an application that then requires them because it's been baked into your app, then whoever delivered that to you now has an opportunity to sell you a product. And so if you are built on MySQL back in the Sun days, we could then sell you premium services or hosting services or anything related to MySQL. If you started building on, SQL Server, we didn't have that opportunity.
Right. So were you part of the acquisition of MySQL? Was that your idea?
No. I came into Sun through the acquisition of my startup in 1996, of a little company called Lighthouse Design. And Lighthouse Design had been started in the late 80s, not to date myself. And a bunch of us got together.
It was developing for Next Step.
We built for Next Step. And so we were the biggest fish in a little raindrop. And we built all the big productivity applications in the Next Step environment and a bunch of developer tools as well.
Some of the best people I know were Next Step developers. There was something
absolutely about
that, not merely Tim Berners-Lee, but there was something about that ecosystem that just really attracted the best.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I think it was...
elegant?
I think it had a very clear purpose. Everyone knew what we were there to go do. And it had a very charismatic leader.
Steve Jobs.
Obviously, no longer with us.
Yeah.
And so I think that level of passion and focus and intensity really attracts the best people. Folks want to be a part of something that's great. And if you've got an opportunity to build something great, they're going to want to join you.
So did Sun come to you and say, we want to buy Lighthouse? Did they want to be in Next Step development? How did that happen?
So if you look at Objective-C and Java and you blur your eyes just a little bit, they kind of look a little similar.
Yeah.
So, back in the day, we had these productivity apps that were, they were selling very well. We had you know, 25, 30 developers and around $10 million in revenue. So we were.
What were the apps?
They had names like Concurrence and Diagram and Taskmaster and OpenWrite. And
so
they were productivity tools.
Tools for next boxes.
Yeah. And remember,
that was a tiny market.
It was a raindrop, a little tiny.
Yeah.
And remember, Next split hardware and software.
Right.
And then the software was partially licensed to Sun and partially licensed to HP because we were going to, you know, back then.
It became OpenStep
and then stopped.
Then became no steps.
Then became
OS 10, which is interesting.
FalterStep.
Yeah.
And so at the time, this was 95, you know, we kind of finally stood up and said, okay, this internet thing is happening. And boy, we have all these assets. We have all these frameworks, all this code, all these apps. How hard would it be for us to rebuild them, recast them in an internet context?
For Java.
For Java. Or for the web broadly. And so we had a few bidders.
That was prescient, though, in 95. Now everybody understands, software as a service, web-based software, cloud. But that's what you're basically saying.
We did a bunch of stuff. It's like when I think back on the team we had, and it was mostly their decision-making. I mean, we had all these interesting philosophies when I was at Lighthouse. Like, all software shall be free to students. And our philosophy was actually, it was very clear. It's like, why? Well, because if it's not, they'll steal it. It's like, great, let's get them out of the guilt ring. Let's just give them the software free.
And there's a business model where they grow up and they start buying it.
And you'll never guess what happened. All those kids who were using our software graduated, went to J.P. Morgan, and all of a sudden we were doing site licenses.
Nice
J.P.
job.
Morgan Chase. So that actually worked, this whole adoption thing.
Nice job.
So in the 95, 96 time frame, we had a bunch of companies that wanted to come talk to us about what we were doing and if we could redo it with them. And Sun ended up being the highest bidder. And so there's a guy there named Eric Schmidt, who was the CTO at the time, who ended up making the decision to buy us. And he was my first boss at Sun. And then
it's really interesting how your career has brought you in contact with Jobs, Schmidt, Scott McNeely, some of the big minds of this era.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bouncing off them like a pinball.
Exactly.
Yeah, what was Schmidt like at the time? Did you get along?
Oh, we got along great. Yeah. He was really, really smart. Just smart and lighthearted, and
he was kind of in the R&D part, right? He was in the blue sky stuff.
Yeah, no, I think he was running before my time. He was running the software group, and then he was the CTO. And he was he was an idea minute. He was great.
Neat.
It was really good.
Neat. So you, Sun acquired Lighthouse.
96.
In 96, you went to work for Sun.
I went to go work for Sun.
Yeah.
And we left the little Lighthouse Design as a standalone entity. And that was really hard to do because having a little tiny company become a part of a really big company is a very difficult thing. And so after about 2 years, I would say, 80% of the folks who were involved were gone.
Oh.
And they had left.
That's a big problem with these acquihires. Which is, it's hard to keep people who have this kind of entrepreneurial spirit in a big company.
You know, I agree and I don't. And I think if you've really thought out what happens, I mean, I think companies that acquire others because they're acquisitive companies will forever have that problem.
Right.
And there are lots of great examples of acquisitive companies. They go off and acquire a mile a minute.
Right.
And they
Yahoo
keep 5%.
Would be a good example.
Right. Yeah. And then they spew people out.
Right.
Others who have a really strong idea of what they want to get done and view acquisitions as a means of helping them go get that done. Mm. Are far more successful, and they're far more successful in keeping folks engaged because you're not just there to get a new T-shirt and a new business card. You're there because
or stock options.
You're there because you play an integral role in helping them achieve something.
Sam Lesson moving to Facebook and creating Timeline is a good example.
Right.
There's a lot of engineers at Google, same thing.
Right.
And then there's a few like the Rasmussens who struggled a little bit.
Well, there's no perfect answer. What I've seen, having done a lot of acquisitions in my day, is if you are acquiring people to help you achieve something greater than what they're currently able to achieve, they all want to see that as well.
And they see the flag in the sand. They say, oh, we can do that. We can do.
Yeah.
And that's our goal.
And sometimes it's nice to have a $1 billion, balance sheet behind you and 10,000 sales
resources.
People across the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great. So now what happened? So Scott McNeely was running Sun when you joined,
right?
And you and Scott became his right hand. How did you end up as CEO? That's kind of an interesting transition.
It was an interesting transition.
Did you imagine ever that would be the outcome of this acquisition? that you'd be running the company in a few years?
No.
I mean, that's kind of weird.
No, but, everything I've ever done, I've just cared really deeply about. I don't want to spend my time on things that I don't care about.
Right.
And, and being a part of Lighthouse, I mean, believe me, the NextStep Marketplace was a hard place to run a business.
Yeah, yeah.
We still ran a business. It was profitable. Well, it made money.
You got it in the nick of time because in a few years it was going to go away entirely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It would or it wouldn't. I mean, it became a part of Apple and it's now, you've got NextStep on your phone now.
Right.
And I think when I was a part of Sun, I just cared really deeply about everything that was going on.
That's
from...
Neat.
What we were doing, for whom we were doing it, how we were doing it, who was a part of the team. And I think, that definitely made it a lot easier to truly invest in what we were getting done. It also made it easier to say, I would love to do more. I'd love
right.
to help out, and, all these different ways. And so, I had the luxury of picking great bosses. And along the way, I just had lots of great opportunities.
Well, it's a legendary company. I mean, a great company. So the best minds in technology worked at Sun. All the things that Sun had.
Absolutely. It had, an exceptional...
And Solaris. ZFS.
You don't have to convince me.
No, I know.
Absolutely.
I'm just marveling. So what happened? What went wrong? This is a great company.
So I think a few things, if I can kind of go back and visit what happened. I remember early on when Linux first started, evolving in the mid-90s. And I remember watching, my developer friends and watching what was going out in the marketplace. And, if you think back in a company like eBay, Pierre Omidyar had a Sun workstation, did a bunch of, noodling around, built eBay. And then by the time, eBay was really, really big, Solaris was baked into how everything was done.
Right.
Right? And so...
There's
no going back. So the decisions that Pierre made at the very beginning informed the revenue opportunity for Sun. So now imagine how many people were actually using Sun workstations to create their businesses in the mid-90s. And what operating system they could actually pick.
They were using Linux.
And they were unable to pick...
Right.
Solaris, because
right.
the decision had been made at the time
right.
to get out of that. That was only doing Intel a favor.
Right.
So that wasn't.
They actually moved it off Intel.
They moved it onto Intel, announced it was being canceled, which is not again because developers are a skittish lot. They want things.
That's not good. It scares everybody.
That scared everybody, and so there's this whole generation of developers that were gone, and therefore a whole generation of market opportunity that
right.
was gone. So partially, what we were trying to do was just try to recover that, work as hard as we could to go get back on the laptops and in front of the developers and in their development environment so that we could be a part of that next wave of market opportunity.
It's a great insight, though. It's the insight you had giving students Lighthouse software. It's the same thing, is that if you get in at the beginning, you become an incumbent, an entrenched.
Well, and you've not only sowed your technology seeds, you've given people the skills, you've
right.
given people the preferences, the culture. I mean, everything that you've thought about, they now have baked into how they build infrastructure.
And conversely, if you miss the boat, it's very, very hard to jump on it after if it's left the pier.
I mean,
you
absolutely can't.
And that's what Sun learned, basically.
Yeah, I would say they
the boat sailed.
The boat sailed, and it was therefore... up to us as a team to try to figure out where else we could go. And so we weren't going to give up on the idea of trying to recover those developers because you can never give up on that. You've always got to be going after them. And acquiring MySQL was certainly a part of that. But we also had to do as good a job as we could with some really tough customers. I mean, Sun's customer base was really concentrated. I mean, probably a third of our customers were banks. And I don't know if you remember back in the 2008, 2009 timeframe, that was a hard place to be because a lot of banks were going bankrupt, across the world.
They were using Sun workstations to develop derivatives and put themselves out of business.
They absolutely did. And so, seeing a third of your revenue just basically go poof,
wow.
That was a tough thing to deal with.
Yeah.
And so we had a bunch of struggles, but we also had good relationships across the marketplace, and that enabled us to go talk to other industry participants and frankly, to try to say, hey, what could we do together? And leave it up to them to figure out ways, that we could partner. And that's ultimately what happened. And it wasn't a smooth process, and, there was a lot of drama in the interim, but, that's where we ended up.
So it's interesting, though, that you say developers are more important in a way than customers. It starts with developers.
For the enterprise?
Yeah.
I was just with another company that was talking about how they were going to build this new high-end system, and it was going to totally eviscerate the low end of the marketplace. And I was thinking, in the history that I've been
when does that happen?
I've never seen that happen. You cannot kill from above. I mean, that may work in the military, but it doesn't work.
Only in the military.
But it doesn't work in my marketplace. Huh. And so, yeah, you've got to build a high-volume product that is then, in some sense, preferencing the marketplace to pay attention to you. And I think, you know, that is the foundation of the freemium model. The freemium model is not simply isolated to good consumer services. It's identical for developer services. You know, Amazon is vacuuming up the marketplace. They're not doing it from the top down. They're doing it from their website.
Right, right.
And as that happens, that creates a massive market opportunity.
Yeah, that's why freemium really works. It does work.
Well, whether it works, free distribution is the simplest and fastest way to proliferate your technology across the world.
That's obvious. What's hard to figure out is how to make money on it then.
I don't think it's that hard. I think it's a lot harder to figure out how to make money if you don't have any customers. So I'd rather go solve problem one,
right.
Get a lot of people right. using your stuff, solve problem two, figure out what it is that they're interested in paying for. Right. And I think for company after company, what you will see, and certainly what we've seen, is oftentimes people just want to pay because they like what you're doing.
Right.
And they want to pay because
right.
they think you're doing a valuable service for them.
Right.
So, you know, you can't miss that.
Right.
I mean, if you watch what happens with Kickstarter and crowdsourcing,
people want to give you money.
There's a whole lot of money out there that wants to find a home. You've just got to be a good job. You've got to do a good job of building a way for it to get to you.
Yeah, we talked a few weeks ago to Phil Lyman of Evernote on this
right.
show.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly that. And I think he has observed that people don't really need to pay for Evernote, but they want to pay for
right.
Evernote. And the music industry never really got that, did they? I think people will pay for content.
Well, I mean, I've had an interesting history with the music industry because we built a lot of infrastructure when I was at Sun for both the providers of the media as well as the
creators,
the distributors of the media who weren't always legitimate in how they were distributing it.
Yeah.
You know, but the funny thing was, before iTunes, a massive amount of music was being stolen.
Right.
And then iTunes came along and a massive amount of music was being purchased.
All of a sudden.
Why? Because all of a sudden it was easier to
point
just buy
access.
It.
Right? Yes,
it was easier to buy it,
and people, I think, want to buy it.
Yeah,
they
right. No one wants to steal.
Right.
And I think if you give them a fair price and a good opportunity, they'll find a way to pay you.
These things all seem so obvious when you say it. Open source works. Give away. You build your customer base. Give stuff away. People want to pay. But at the same time, most of the world doesn't seem to get it.
Well, I think for many people, it's counterintuitive. You know, I think the
how am I going to make money if I give it away?
Exactly. Well, and we still had that, you know, time after time. I mean, I've spent lots of time with folks who are maybe, and I don't think it's a generational thing. I think it's a cultural thing. You know, you sit with a CIO who is, you know, I saw this 100 times. You sit with a CIO who's built a massive distributed global application that relies upon MySQL.
Right.
And he doesn't have to pay you anything.
Right. It's free.
But he's looking for a way to give you the biggest check he can to make sure that you totally protect him in the event something goes wrong. And the cost of downtime to him is $1 million an hour.
Right.
And when you deliver him a purchase order for premium support for $20 million, he's like, between the seat cushions. Let me get that for you.
No sweat.
Right. And so that's counterintuitive because for most people, you take them off the street, you put them in the CIO's, you know, shoes, and you could say, okay, you could save $20 million. And in the moment, they'll say, that's brilliant. I'd love to save $20 million. Right. It's like, no, because the moment something happens.
It's a foolish economy.
You've made a bad choice.
Yeah.
So, and I think that applies, you know, I've been reading the LA Times recently, and, you know, there was a period there where I wanted to read the article, and I couldn't actually read the article unless I paid, so I said, fine, close the window.
Yes.
I mean, I assume at some point somebody at the LA Times realized, wow, this doesn't appear
He's
to be
not
working
reading
for
it. We got to get Jonathan to read these articles. No, but you know, when I close that window, it almost gives me satisfaction. Like, okay, fine.
And so I think we are very much in a marketplace now where consumers are in charge as opposed to 25 years ago where enterprises were in charge. And great news. And that means if you do a good job of pleasing consumers, they'll reward you by giving you money.
I'm guessing you have lots of opinions about
how
businesses are being run now. Facebook, Twitter, Apple, Google. Can you talk about that, or would you prefer not to?
Oh, I'm happy to talk about it.
You don't
like
mind?
I'm not sure my opinions are all that noteworthy.
Well, I'm interested.
I think that, you know, all those businesses are making choices which are, you know, which are good for them.
And well, they're playing a game of chess. They're trying to make a choice which is good for them.
Well, I guess, you know, the problem I have with, you know, Facebook and Google and to a lesser extent Twitter and a much lesser extent Apple, you know, there's a level of duplicity in what's going on, which is we'll give you all of this great stuff, and that's how we're going to buy your privacy.
Right.
And then you're not actually our customer. You're our product.
Right.
We're not going to tell you that. We're going to call you our users and our
right.
customers. And then we're going to go sell access to you to our advertisers. And so, you know, I was watching, you know, some of the European privacy legislation and the dialogue around that and people fighting privacy, saying it's bad for consumers. It's like, you know, I've never heard a consumer wake up and say, I've got too much privacy. It's time for me to, you know, tear everything off and live in the open.
But your predecessor said very famously, privacy's dead. Get over it.
I think what he said is, yeah, something to that end.
Similar.
And when you're an infrastructure provider, that's a very salacious thing to say, but you're not giving up anything by saying
Scott liked to say salacious things.
Well, he did, because we could ride on both sides of that, right? We could ride on
you
the
don't
privacy
really care.
Advocates. Right. We're here.
Right.
We're an arms supplier. We're neutral.
So you think Google needs, let's use Google as an example. Facebook's could be also, should be more upfront with its users about what the trade-off is, what the economic tit-for-tat is?
I think, you know, as a consumer, I would like to have vastly more control and much simpler control over what information is actually being tracked and where it's going and how it's being used. And I would like to
Of course you would.
Right.
But isn't it a little disingenuous to say, well, look at all, Facebook, it's free. Look at that. Look at all that great stuff I get from Google. It's free. It's free. I'll take it. And then when Google says, well, yeah, but we got to pay for the servers somehow.
Right. I guess if they were more transparent about that, I would have, you know, less of a hard time.
They're
about
pretty
it.
Transparent. I mean, they've got a dashboard. You can see what they know. You can turn off stuff.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
How transparent do you want them to be?
Well, I want them to be as transparent that, you know,
the grandma
as they
knows.
Can be.
Grandma
right.
understands.
Well, the folks who don't actually understand what's going on, that a legacy of information is being kept about them.
Right.
That it can be used in ways that may not be, you know, necessarily ideal for them.
You know why we don't tell anybody that? I'll be Google. Because if they knew, they'd be terrified and they'd turn everything off and then we'd have no business model. We can't tell them. We can't be honest with them.
Well, I think if your business model is predicated upon deceit, you've already got some challenges that you maybe haven't faced up to.
Is it possible for Facebook or Google to succeed and be honest with their customers and say,
well,
this is the trade?
I would like to believe that that's the foundation of every effective
But you
business.
Just said you want to have absolute control and you probably would choose, you would opt for more privacy, not less.
That's not
right?
necessarily true. I mean, you know, Esther Dyson a long time ago had this great perspective on, so if you look at the retail industry, so you walk into your average grocery store, they make as much money on the data about you as they do
right.
on the products they're selling.
Yeah, that's why they push that club card.
Which is they push the club card. And so, you know, Esther had, I was part of a panel with her a while back, and she was saying, look, it's totally okay that they're doing it, but I would like to be in charge. It's my information, and I'm happy to sell it back to them. And I probably would sell it back to them because I don't care that much about how many apples I bought when they introduced this new discount.
Right.
But I would like to be asked. So in the healthcare environment right now, there's this piece of legislation in the U.S. which is replicated in many ways around the world called HIPAA.
Yeah.
And what HIPAA says is, it's your data, full stop, end of sentence. There's no, like, duplicity, and we're not going to really, you know, tell you what you can and what you can't. If I make a request of my healthcare provider that says, give me my medical records, they are, you know, by federal legislation, they're obligated to give me that data. It's mine.
It's
no
a portability questions. And privacy.
Absolutely.
Act. Two P's in HIPAA.
And so, why is that any different? In the
right.
banking world, why is it any
right.
different in the browsing world? Why is it any different about where I'm driving around in the city? That's my information.
So should there be a HIPAA, a global HIPAA for
I
privacy?
I absolutely believe there ought to be a global HIPAA for all information about me. If it's being aggregated by somebody else without my knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and even if it's with my knowledge, again, I just want to know how it's going to be used.
And you want like a price chart, like, okay, you tell us this, it's worth this much and that kind of thing?
No, I just want to know everything
what they're
they
doing.
Know, and I want to know what their plans are with it, and I want them to ask my permission to use it.
Google would say, well, we're doing that. We've got a very clear English written privacy policy.
Yeah, it's 57 pages long. It's the clearest thing I've ever read. You know, it's like.
By the way, you've won about 1,000 fans in the chat room who are absolutely agreeing with you. But I also see the other side, which is that we get a lot of free services. Google's a good example. I mean, I use all the Google stuff. It's great. And you're right. I would like control, but I would like the choice. But I think if you're sophisticated, you know, right? And if you decide to use Google Docs and Google Calendar and Google Mail, you know.
What did you just say? If you're sophisticated, you know?
Yeah.
And so what does that mean?
Like, a lot of people don't know.
Like the naive people, they're
those
you
poor
know.
Schmucks don't.
Right. Yeah, oh, well.
Don't know.
Right. So the 1%
but they
are really
want
clued
for,
in. They got it. They understand it. So it's okay.
But why aren't people thinking to themselves, well, why am I getting this for free?
You know, I'm not worried about that. What I'm worried about is I believe that the information about me is mine.
It is.
It is no one else's.
No one denies that.
Right. Well, yeah. I think a lot of companies deny that by saying, hey, we gave you this really complicated opaque document.
And you just gave us permission.
Right. You gave us permission. You signed the terms and conditions.
Right. And you think a government regulation is the right way to do this?
No, I think
industry
effective privacy legislation.
Okay,
I'm not a huge fan of federal oversight and
because notoriously they're not very good at doing this stuff.
Well, they did a pretty good job with HIPAA.
HIPAA was good.
Yeah, HIPAA was great, and HIPAA can and what I'm talking about can be bounded very clearly.
Yeah.
And I think it would be interesting, if we pursued that to see who would show up on the other side. Because inevitably, you have a bunch of companies showing up saying, you don't need more privacy. You don't. Trust me.
That's exactly why they have all those people running around in the halls of Congress making sure that nothing like
this
comes
up. And that's exactly why we built CareZone.
So we're going to talk about CareZone. This is your new startup.
Yeah.
You launched it just this year.
Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Valentine's Day, February.
So what is CareZone? I got it all wrong because I just assumed it was a healthcare portability.
No. So I, about a little over a decade ago, I had my first child, and he had a bunch of complications, and it happens. And so all of a sudden, my wife and I had to start managing and tracking a bunch of information. And some of it was health-related, but it was developmental. We needed to know who, this therapist was and this babysitter was, and we had a caregiver here, and we needed to just keep track of stuff. And then we had to share the stuff. And then every parent has run into the experience of, my partner and I are going out to dinner. That's why we have a babysitter. So here's all the emergency contact information.
Oh, that long list.
And where is that? It's usually handwritten out.
Yep.
So that ought to be digital at some point.
Yep.
And when you look at the kind of information you're managing, that's not the kind of stuff you want to share with your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother...
Or Google.
And then my brother's family had a bunch of issues, and he had a bunch of folks he wanted to keep up to date, and he needed a safe place to do it. And then my parents, as I was joking with them recently, just decided to get old one day. It's like, boom.
How dare you?
How dare you? And they did me the favor of actually caring for me when I was vulnerable, so I figured I would try to help out with them. And now, you don't want folks to know about, what's going on with your dad's surgery and when he's getting home and, how they manage their house and what the pass lock to his garage is and, where do you put the, bank passwords and online accounts? And so all of a sudden especially in our generation, when you're kind of sandwiched between children and your parents, where is it that you have a safe place to keep stuff, first and foremost, that has a privacy policy that's actually, about a page long and rational and says no ads, no data mining, we don't have access to your data, full stop. And then secondarily, one that you can share with a non-sophisticated family, as well as extended family, caregivers, babysitters, somebody who stops in to check on your dad's meds. So that's what we wanted to build. That's what Walter Smith, my co-founder, and I wanted to do. We wanted to build a safe place that could help you care for your family, that you could share with your extended family, and that would just be a family utility, just a very simple social resource.
Is it free?
It is free. And,
well, how the hell are you going to pay for this?
That's not my priority right now. I mean, my priority is
you got
making
a
sure
data mine, dude. There's no money in this. You gotta.
That's
you're
true.
Not
we're
gonna.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I will tell you from the users we have.
I'm sure they're thrilled. They're getting a great freebie.
No. Our revenue model is not going to be a challenge.
It'll be freemium.
It will undeniably be freemium,
yeah.
And I think you're going to see some...
People will want to give you money.
They already do, and it's like, folks, we don't have billing set up. It's like, stop it.
No, we can't take money.
Yeah, and so I'm not worried about
that. I love that. So you just say, if we build it, it'll work out.
And our primary product, our mainline product, is going to be a free product. And
it's an iOS app.
It is an iOS app. It is we're in our early release of the iOS app, so you can go to the App Store and just go look for CareZone. And you'll find our app. And again, it's still pretty basic on the iPhone. It's more full featured right now on the web.
So there's a web version as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
they'll sync, obviously. So
they are the same thing.
I could hand it off to the babysitter. I could say, "Here's my USB key."
You just say, "I invite you." She gets an email. She says, "Great, I got your account."
Right.
And then when you catch her smoking on the back porch, you hit the little trash can button,
revoke.
And boom, she's gone.
Is that why Google Health failed? Because Google Health...
I think Google Health failed for a number of reasons. First of all, do you really want to sell your health history to a company that's going to sell ads against it? I mean, give me a break. That's just an IQ test. That wasn't a business experiment.
So people aren't so stupid as we thought.
No, exactly.
They figured that out.
Secondly...
By the way, I gave them everything. I put it, pumped everything.
Well, you live a transparent life. I wouldn't be surprised if you don't take a microphone when you leave this building. But, you know, I think the other reason why Google Health failed is they presumed you actually wanted to track your information.
Right. It's not me.
No, it's not me. It's my kid.
Right.
And do you really think I'm going to, like, set up a Facebook account for my kid so I can keep track of stuff and have it complete? No, not going to happen. So where are you going to take care of somebody else?
This makes a lot of sense.
I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, but I want to generalize it. I mean, it shouldn't just be care. It should be everything. I have all my data. I need somewhere to put stuff and be able to granularly share my contact information.
And there's no question. And so I think one of the most it's interesting. We were talking a little bit before we started the live part of this. Sorry. The broadcast
department. We're always live, baby.
You know, about the iPhone app, that probably the most useful feature for me right now with my wife is we have a shared contact list.
Right.
And that shared contact list is everybody associated with my kids, everybody associated with our little community,
so
and everybody
have...
associated with my parents. So because we're both on the same contact list and there's six other people who have access to that list, whenever anybody makes a change, we're all made aware of it instantaneously. So I think there is, you know, for a family, there are a lot of things that go well beyond health. Health is just one of the items.
Yeah, absolutely. And so at some point you do think you might. Because I'd like to do that. More general. My kids are grown now, so I don't care about them anymore. And my parents aren't quite dead yet, so I don't care about them. So there's more we could store.
No, there absolutely is. And there's simple stuff. Like, so whenever you walk into your house and you look at that desk, that desk that used to serve like a utility.
Yeah.
Because it used to be
dining room table?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that desk.
Where you used to put your computer before you stopped, carrying a computer. You know, so where do you keep the deed to your house? Where do you keep the key pass to your garage?
No idea.
And so where all the kind of little pieces of private information that you care about, how do we give you a place to put them that can be shared but still be secure? That's exactly what we're trying to achieve.
CareZone.com. Well, you do have, after a year, you pay $5 a month.
Yeah, I think we're going to change that.
The year isn't up yet. So
partially what happened was, you know, we unveiled the service in February. We had this big rush of users come in, and we made all these assumptions about how people would be using it and what they would be doing with it. And so we established a relationship with an autism foundation called Autism Speaks. And then we started hearing from folks who had autistic kids what they care about. And it wasn't what we expected.
Oh,
a huge number of autistic parents care about the diet that their child has because they appear to have some incredible gluten sensitivity.
Right.
We started working with folks in the Parkinson's community, assuming that what we were going to do was, again, focus on folks who had maladies. And what we heard from them was they had these very complicated, you know, medication regimens, which is why our medications, you know, features have gotten a lot more robust and powerful. But what we've seen along the way is that if you have an autistic child, statistically, you also have one who's not autistic, who's not on the spectrum. And if, you know, one of your parents is, you know, unfortunate enough to have Parkinson's, you have another parent who doesn't have Parkinson's.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not just about, you know, people with health issues or challenges. It's about people who are living life.
Right.
I mean, everyone will get old. Everyone has parents, alive or dead. Everyone's got parents.
Right.
Many people have kids. Some of them have challenges. We all just have this kind of stew of information, some of which is brilliantly well served by Facebook. I mean, I wouldn't take anything away from that. I think they've done an amazing job of building an incredibly valuable service, but it's for a very specific part of your life.
And they can't do this because we already know that they sell our information. So
yes.
We don't trust them.
Privacy is toxic to their revenue model.
Right.
It is the foundation of ours. So I think we're not worried about Facebook moving into our space.
Well, I wouldn't be. I mean, Google tried with, Google with Health.
They tried. They did.
Didn't work so good, but they tried. All
right,
so people can go to carezone.com, sign up there, start entering data there, get the iOS app. Are you going to do an Android app?
We're absolutely going to do an Android app.
I beg of you.
Absolutely.
And you said it's all open source software. What are you using?
What are we not using?
Is it Rails? Is it Django?
It's Rails and obviously JavaScript and building on...
JSQuery?
And JSQuery and Backbone.
Node.
And running on
stuff.
Postgres and on Linux and Amazon's, core part of our infrastructure. Not MySQL. We're all about understanding IP licenses.
I like Postgres.
We love Postgres. Postgres is a great community and a great product.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, it's really nice to meet you. You were a breath of fresh air when you were running Sun, and Sun, you know, is now part of Oracle.
It is.
Yeah.
And they're doing, you know...
How'd you and Larry get along?
You know...
You were shopping Sun actively you were shopping it, weren't you?
Shopping's not really the word. We were looking for alternatives. When our business, when we saw what we saw, which is that just an utter kind of global economic collapse,
yeah.
Everyone was out looking for opportunities.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that we had a safe landing. I wanted to make sure that, you know, in the event of things, we had to be.
You were a good steward. Yeah.
And I know we frustrated an awful lot of people because they all told me.
According to Wikipedia, Scott McNeely wasn't so happy.
There were a lot of people who weren't very happy because they didn't like the idea of this company ultimately being sold.
No, because Sun is legendary.
It
remains legendary. Sun was like Apple for a certain group of people.
And absolutely. But, you know, I think what folks have to remember is, you know, the majority of our business, the majority was selling spark boxes.
Right.
So I don't care how much you work. I mean, it's when that business is shrinking at the rate that it was, it was nearly impossible to grow the software side of the business or the service side of the business fast enough to offset that loss.
Had you gotten in there earlier, knowing what you know, do you think you could have made it, the company could have survived?
I think it would be arrogant to suggest that. I think there are some decisions I wish that we had made differently. I wish I had been more persuasive, and there's a whole bunch of us that wish we'd been more persuasive. But on the other hand, you know, when you're in the midst of it and, you know, trying to make decisions, everybody's got.
It's
and look,
that
is a company that was very well managed, created an enormous number of jobs. And I remember, you know, I had this an immense amount of value. And, you know, and some of my favorite people are still there.
Yeah.
And I wish them well because I think it's a tough environment. But, you know, you look at what Meg Whitman is going through right now at HP. Mm. You know, we sold Sun for about $8 billion or so.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't checked HP's market cap recently, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were sold for about what Sun was sold for, because there's just not a lot of IP there that's going to be sustainable. And so we were very focused on making sure that we got $8 billion and not $1
billion. Right.
So I think as difficult as it was and as controversial as it was very much the right decision, and the board was very courageous to support the decision and to drive it forward.
When you know how difficult it is and you look at something like how Apple was run, it really is impressive to see how they threaded the needle to go from a company that was 3 months away from bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And so quickly to turn it around. It's really quite impressive.
Well, I think what, you know, in some sense, the luxury that Steve had was they were pre-disastered.
Right.
So they were.
It's like they had their train wreck.
But they were shrunk.
Yeah.
And
oh, I see what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
So there wasn't this continual downdraft. So almost anything they did that began to turn the nose up was going to be immediately, you know, beneficial.
Right.
And because remember, it was an awfully long time between the point where Steve took over again and when the iPod shipped. I mean, it was years and years and years.
Right.
And there was that dark period in between, which
was struggling.
You know,
They
got money from Microsoft. And I remember, you know, talking to Steve in that period. It was not a pleasant time to be CEO at Apple.
I can only imagine.
You know, but all that said, that company is so filled with innovative, creative, passionate people. As Sun, you know, was filled with creative, passionate people, what we needed was time. And it's the one thing we didn't have.
Yeah.
And the financial crisis really, you know, shrunk time.
Yeah.
And so could we have taken a different path? I think given the options we had at the time, you know, one of the things, and just some insight for you and others about how the mechanics of shrinking a company work, if you're going to take care of your workers when you fire them, when you lay them off, which is an inevitable part of shrinking a company, you don't want to do that by saying goodbye. You want to do that by giving them a check and trying to take care of them and understanding it's a tough transition. So we maintained a very generous severance policy for a long time. And now when you do that, if you lay off 2,000 workers and you're giving them all 6 months' wages, it ends up being a huge cash drain. So in the midst of the shrinkage, you've got this added pressure of we need to let people go, but that takes our cash balance down. There's some point where you go, folks, these lines are never going to cross. We can't do it. And we're not going to stand up and say that externally, because that's obviously a really,
That makes it even faster.
That makes it even faster. And so we had, you know, there's just a lot of interesting. One day someone will write a book, it just won't be me, about what went on with IBM at the time. Because I don't know if you remember this, but IBM was out talking about, you know, geez.
They were your competitor. They were head-to-head
competitors. They absolutely
were
our competitor. And I could never, of course, comment on confidential discussions that took place between Sun and IBM, whether they took place or not. But the FBI can comment on them because they disclosed in their indictment of Bob Moffitt.
They recorded the whole thing.
who was, you know, later, as I said, indicted for insider trading. You know, that they that was really complicated. That made life a lot worse because you don't want to have your biggest competitor out there saying, geez, there are all these rumors that Sun might be sold. So it was just a really complicated environment with, again, some of the most well-meaning, committed, smart people who are working their brains out, you know, trying to get good things to happen. But there's just a reality.
You actually convinced me that you had got the best of all possible outcomes.
And I think we did. And, you know, it was a tough time. And let me tell you, it's a real pleasure being a part of a little tiny company who every day, I mean.
And it makes a difference in people's lives and people thank you. And
Totally. Yeah. Well, and also, you know. The
IBM's not going around bad-mouthing.
No, not anymore. They just want us to buy IBM computers, but we don't buy computers.
Yeah, that's good. They don't sell them, really. So you're all right. You're good.
They rent them.
You
know, but being in a small company, I've got more data today about the daily operations at CareZone than I had about the daily operations at Sun.
Isn't that interesting?
It is.
You'd think the CEO would know everything. It's just too complicated.
Well,
it's
too complicated, and it's a business that's been built over 25 years.
There's lots of corners, lots of nooks and crannies.
Well, this one, you know, CareZone, everything is instrumented. Everything.
Oh, that's neat.
Like, I could tell you how many, you know, visits we just had in the last 20 minutes. And,
was that intentional in the design?
Absolutely.
You wanted to know it all.
I wanted to know it all, and the technologists we have are brilliant and fabulous, and they make sure that everything is as instrumented as it can be, in part because that allows us to make better decisions. I mean, we run A/B experiments all day long every day.
Oh, really?
And you learn interesting stuff. I mean, so I'll give you my favorite kind of counterintuitive learning. We had on our landing page, we had 3 screenshots. So if you came to the page and you wanted to go look at, you know, what the app was, go click on the screenshot, you get a picture of what the contact list looks like or what the journal looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the page that was up that had no screenshots on it. And so we've been running an experiment recently.
I see no screenshots.
And so which do you think would be more effective? The one that gives you screenshots?
Screenshots. No, the one with the happy lady smiling.
The happy lady smiling was constant between the two.
But there's no screenshots here.
Yeah, why
there's
is that?
Video.
It's because screenshots suppress conversion. I mean, who would have thought that?
Why is that, do you think?
I can give you my theory, but we haven't...
You just know the result.
Yeah, I don't go interview, 10,000 users. But my theory is when you come to a site, you have a finite click allowance in your head.
Right.
And so if we soak up a couple of them on
a screenshot... You used up all the clicks.
You've used up the clicks, so you may as well just go register and go get it that way. So I don't know, but the point is...
But by the way, that's an argument for obfuscation, not an argument for clarity.
It is. It totally
I hate to
is.
Tell you that.
No. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that occur, and we have to make decisions about what the right answer is. Because I'll tell you, Walter's response to that was, I hate that answer. It is the wrong answer. We just have to figure out a better way of conveying the information we want to, convey, because we don't want to say, we don't want to just have a landing page where you come and it says, register
just
here.
Just do it.
Register
do
here.
Do it.
We'll tell you about
don't think about it. Do it. But that works.
It does.
It's often a challenge for people who want to be honest and responsible, because sometimes that's not, transparency may not be effective.
I think in the long term, transparency is the most effective.
You have to believe. You have to have an ethical belief and a foundational belief.
Well,
but
I think
there's a reason why politicians are the way they are.
Yes. I totally believe that.
And unfortunately, it's true.
And disappointing in many ways, but also very rational.
And there's a reason why it's the way it is. And I suspect there's a reason why the way Google and Facebook are the way they are.
Well, they've built a revenue model. And I'm not saying it's a bad revenue model. It's just not my revenue model.
Right. CareZone.com if you want to find out more. There's no screenshots, but just sign up. You know, it's free.
Exactly. Watch the video.
There's a little I like these cartoon characters. These are very reminiscent of... there's a style. Did you go out and hire... It reminds me a lot of the Virgin America... safety film, but you don't know who did this. It's cool. It's cute.
Yeah.
I like it. Watch the video. That's one click.
That's one click.
So there you go.
And you don't have that many to spend, but we register. Want you to spend one on the video.
It is such a thrill to meet you, and you are live up to the promise. It's really, really interesting to hear your candid, honest insights, and I wish you luck with CareZone, and come back and we'll talk some more.
Good. I'll look forward to it.
Yeah. Jonathan Schwartz, CareZone.com. We do triangulation on Wednesdays around about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. With the time change, that is going to be 2100 UTC starting next week. So change your time. I will not be here for the next 3 weeks. Who's hosting? Do you know? We don't know. Who's hosting, Karsten?
Next week is
Tom Merritt. Come here, Karsten. Put on your goggles. Tom Merritt will be hosting next week. And I know we had promised horror writer... what's his name?
Richard
Richard Codrey. We couldn't get Codrey had an emergency, so we were actually very happy that Jonathan's voice. Here's the producer of our show, ladies and gentlemen, and he's the only person at the entire Twit Brick House to wear a costume today.
Liz wore a Batman costume.
Well, let's see Batman. Where's Batman?
Or Batgirl.
Iaz was a cop. He was a cop. All right.
Chad's
got. He brought a trident. That does not count. I'm very disappointed. Wait a minute. Come here. Lorik's wearing. What? Lorik, are you the darks? Are you the Lord of the Sith?
I don't have my mask.
He doesn't have his mask. All right.
It's at the front.
Well,
desk.
None of you are getting candy, so get the heck out of here. I'm throwing eggs at your house. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Likewise.
Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.